population of developing country cities is growing at 3 or 4% a year. Their incomes are rising. There is an incredible need to densify use in the city.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. And welcome to another episode based on this year's BREAD IGC virtual PhD level course in economics on urbanization and the economics of cities in low and middle income countries. As cities grow and spread, the uses to which the land is put and the value of that land will also change. And the challenges of urban planning, construction, urban renewal are complicated, but the way we address those challenges has profound impacts for the people who live and will live in that physical city. Vernon Henderson of the London School of Economics, Maisie Wong of the University of Pennsylvania presented the lecture on the physical city, and they join me now. Maisie, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim.
And Vernon, welcome as well.
Thank you, Tim.
Vernon, in developing country cities, I'm talking about this constant renewal. How much faster does the use of land change than in cities in high-income countries?
Much faster. The population of developing country cities is growing at 3 or 4% a year. Their incomes are rising. There is an incredible need to densify use in the city, to increase intensity of investment. Going to a developing country city, you see these construction cranes all over the place. There are construction projects going on. You go into an American city, you go into Paris or London. Sure, there's some construction in certain parts of the city, but nothing on this scale. As an example, in Nairobi, 11-year time period leading up to 2015, about 35% of buildings were torn down in the central part of the city, not the exact core, but next to the core of the city. And in a developed country city, it would be 5 or 6%. It's just enormously different.
And I've seen research on Paris and London and American cities. Does this difference mean that that research doesn't really apply in this context?
You have the same economic principles in some sense, but the contexts are completely different. Different in really two dimensions. One is that when we think of developed country cities, we're thinking of institutions that work very well, land market institutions, capital market institutions, governance, the ability of cities to raise money or the national government to raise money and to do investments. In developing country cities, you have, in some cases, quite weak institutions, land markets that work very badly, capital markets where there's a lot of misallocation and bias in the allocation. You have cities unable to raise money, even if they have, in theory, a property tax. They may not collect very much from it, and they're struggling to figure out how to do better on collections. So you've got to start and think about different types of institutions, evolving institutions, and try and change your models, change your way of thinking to adapt to that. The other thing that I would note is that the densities of population per square kilometer, however you want to measure it, that you see in developing country cities is multifold what you would see in developed country cities. Maybe there's one little tiny spot in Paris where the population density is more than 20,000 people per square kilometer, but that would be it in all of Europe. Whereas in sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, you would have 20% of the people living at population densities over 20,000 people per square kilometer. So unless you go and live in those countries and spend a lot of time there, which I've done, which Macy's done, you don't have a sense of how different it is.
It is really the degree that is so different. And of course, institutions, but also the capacity of planners and governments, which varies quite a bit. I will say that I think that some of the research from Paris and New York is useful in that it informs how cities can work to promote positive spillovers, minimize congestion issues. But it is something that I guess is familiar to development economists that contexts matter a lot here. And we talked about all those different ways in which the contexts matter.
City planning is at the heart of our topic today, but city planning isn't done by economists, is it? I think many economists wish they could do it. It's done by city planners. And are there factors that city planners consider that maybe economic research at the moment isn't considering?
We live in separate worlds. I mean, you know, they're really planning cities. They're thinking about traffic flows on a micro and a macro level, what streets are feeding into each other, how to do the bus system, the tram system, the tube system, whatever the case may be. They're dealing with externalities on a scale that we don't really think about. What uses are you going to lump together? Or how are you going to have a gridiron structure with rectangular blocks and four-way intersections? They think about aesthetics, which economists don't really think about. 50 years ago, there was a few papers trying to deal with some of this stuff, and there's been nothing since. We mostly play a role where we look at what planners have done, and we say, oh my God, they made a mess here, right? And we can tell you how much of a mess they made and how costly that mess was, but unfortunately, economists and planners don't talk, and at least they talk to a very limited extent. I think that's really unfortunate.
When we teach, I think students come to us from how they interact with cities, and they expect us to have expertise in planning, in markets. And so I do think that it is upon us, like how we do research and how we create knowledge, to actually be more integrated. And there's a lot we can learn from each other. And I think this varies a lot. Some urban and real estate economists are in School of Urban Planning and School of Policy. Some are in business schools and some are in economics departments. This varies quite a bit. And I do think that the more we can do to learn from each other, that would be really great, because the students who come, who want to learn about how cities can work for people, they don't consider this to be different sets of knowledge.
When you look at the best of the research, economic research on this topic, I include the research that both of you have done, you have to respect the lengths that you go to acquire the data that you need to be able to do the analysis. Is dealing with that lack of data one of the things that really stands in your way?
I think it's a challenge. And maybe you change your data sources. I use a lot of satellite data, aerial photo data, Google Maps. We scrape the web for price listings. People use cell phone data if they can get access to it. So there's a lot of what we call big data and seeing images from above, using machine learning to try and automate in some sense and categorize what you're seeing, depending on the resolution of the satellite data. So that was our initial thought. We had a big project in Africa that lasted 7 or 8 years on different research. And we thought, well, we're going to do this kind of all from above and internet sources. Then you go to these countries. In some cases, they have censuses. And if you're there, in some cases, you can get it at a more detailed level than it's publicly available. So you have to invest in going into the countries, spending time there, meeting the people who have data, going to the Census Bureau, being annoying and in some sense, and extracting data from people. The other thing is that you have to do field work. I mean, you have to go in and in the end, you're going to be doing surveys, hiring a local team and training them and then utilizing them perhaps over some years. So we have a team in Tanzania that we've been working with off and on for probably 7 or 8 years. They're college graduates who we employ, and they've become really good at conducting surveys and doing data analysis for us. You have to spend time in the field. You have to make that investment.
I think in rural settings, you could maybe get a national survey and it's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah.
For urban settings, in my experience, at least, each government has its own silos and they have property rights over their own data. And in some places, it's very easy to get data to all sorts of aspects of urban settings. In some other cities, you actually do have to go to each local government and develop a relationship. And that sometimes can be quite difficult, especially for junior researchers. Surveys is definitely really helpful. It's quite different doing it in urban settings because people are just not always at home. They tend to be pretty busy, but there definitely are more surveys being done now. And surveys is great because I think we have very good data for satellite imagery, for scraping data online, mobile phones data. We don't have a lot of data that connects people with places over time. Mm-hmm. That would be very helpful. Administrative data is always welcome, but there's always this concern that sometimes by definition, informal residents, informal workers are not in administrative data or they're not always represented well. And so that's just something to be mindful of.
Now now that we have access to satellite data in cities, you can look down on cities in developing countries. And I mean, the thing that really jumps out is that they're very, I think the technical term is higgledy-piggledy compared to somewhere like Barcelona or Paris. But this was not universally or always the case, was it?
I think we'll use Africa as an example, but it would apply to India. We're talking pre-colonial era. There was locals who did planning and built, obviously, planned cities, and we have ancient planned cities.
Yeah.
But in the colonial era, when the colonialists came in many countries, they, in the cities, planned their own section of the city, which was tiny, and it really did nothing in what they called the native section. So whether this is Calcutta or Nairobi or whatever city you want to pick on. And so the result was you had this really hodgepodge of uses and no real cohesion, even in the road system or anything. Starting about 50 years ago, the World Bank engaged in programs that they called sites and services, where the idea was we're going to provide planned neighborhoods laid out, and we're going to title the land and then give it to people or sell it at a discount or at a very low price. And they're going to self-build. And their idea was, we can't do anything about the existing city, which I think is too bad to say that, but we're going to look at these greenfield developments that are outside the city because they're greenfield, so they're farmland, and we're going to plan those at least, and we're going to offer these nice residential neighborhoods.
And how well did that work?
I think it worked very well. It depends what your criterion is. So their idea at the time was this was going to be low-income housing, and this was a solution to housing people who had low incomes who were typically living in slums. And in many countries, the allocation was geared towards low-income people. The thing is that people acquired plots and then they sold them.
Yeah.
They either built upon them and a little entrepreneurial, and then was better housing, better plot than they could afford and they wanted to consume. So they sold and they made a capital gain, if you like. They enriched themselves, or they just sold the plot. And then somebody who was more middle income, who really valued having this planning and this layout and these bigger plots. I mean, the plots were bigger in many cases. They were constrained by national zoning regulations that the rest of the city wasn't constrained by because they were ignored. But since these were government or government sponsored in conjunction with the World Bank programs, they felt obliged to obey zoning regulations, which really were more designed for middle class housing. So these created what are today middle class neighborhoods. These planned areas have held in their planning. The street layouts are there. The plot layouts are pretty much the same. The cities have grown out beyond these greenfield areas, absorbed these areas, and these are now middle-class neighborhoods. And the houses and the plots sell at a premium because they're valued for the fact that they're nicely laid out. It isn't a hodgepodge.
The policy, it seems to have left some kind of positive physical legacy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have a rising middle class in these countries, right? It's not just rich and poor anymore. You have a rising middle class, and that middle class is growing, and now a significant part of the population in many countries of educated people, and this is what they want, and it's very hard for the market to offer that given all the institutional problems. So you have these settings where you have, first of all, these old programs that were ended about 30 years ago in terms of implementation, but now national governments have picked up on this and they're doing their own programs.
However you implement the program, then there will always be this continuous demand for reconstruction, for being able to reuse space. How important is it that governments, that builders can continuously reconstruct within the boundaries of the city on plots that already have buildings, but they can reuse that space?
I think it's a critical part. You're tearing down buildings, whatever, they have a life of 40, 50, 60 years. And after that 60 years, land prices have risen so much, the demand to have taller buildings, more intensive use is really high. And so you do end up tearing down a large parts of the city. That doesn't mean you don't retain historically significant buildings, that you have these middle-class neighborhoods like from the World Bank's historical program that are just fitting the population almost perfectly right now in terms of what their demands were. At the time, they were too far away and the plot's too big, but now they serve this middle class. So there are sections you're going to preserve and sections where there's a demand to have historical space, but you're going to renew large parts of the city. And that's going to be an ongoing thing because you just have so much demand to use the space.
For any of us who spent time in cities in low-income countries, one of the surprising things is you walk from one neighborhood, a fairly affluent neighborhood, then suddenly you're in something that you'd only describe as a slum, and it's ringed by other affluent neighborhoods as well. And you think, how does this persist? You highlighted the Kibera slum in Nairobi. Why do these little islands of poverty, bad housing, still exist when obviously there must be a demand for that space?
There are many reasons, and I think Macy can address some of that for Jakarta. Mm-hmm. And what we observe in Africa and Asia, it has to do with land issues. You have pockets of land where the ownership of the land is really unclear. The government may have claimed the land, but other people have claims to the land, and generally the government isn't managing that land. There can be areas of cities in Latin American cities where the land title is under dispute for historical reasons before titles were written down and people used bills of sale and the land was sold more than once. Each piece, if you go into a city like Nairobi, Kibera has a particular history, a land grant to the King's Rifles Nubian soldiers well over 115 years ago, gave them that land in perpetuity. But then when the colonial government left, the new government came in, they revoked those claims. But then the Nubians retain a moral claim to the land, or their descendants reclaim a moral right to at least the land that they were using at the time. And so you get frozen. And in that case, sometimes, you know, you have people who are operating slum housing. In the case of Nairobi, it's the majority of people operating slum houses are government officials and politicians. They have very profitable businesses. They're opposed to redevelopment because they're going to lose their profitable businesses. So you just have these histories of you've tried to fix the institutions and you fixed it for large parts of the city, but there are parts that remain where the land is frozen, basically, in either no use or in slum use.
I think this issue of slum redevelopment and why the slums persist next to formal sectors is a very big topic. There's a lot of complicated issues involved. It's the same as some of the debate we have around gentrification, even in the US, coming back to some of the things you said about lessons learned from Paris and New York. Just nobody likes change. However, when we think about slum redevelopment into formal housing, the degree and the complexity is also another level. Normally, if there's a change, so a developer comes in, pays a price, knows who exactly to buy the land from or buy the property from. So that part of the process is a little bit more known, right? So you know who the owner is. You might still have holdout issues, but just the degree of it is less. If there's a dispute, there's a way for you to manage that dispute or resolve that dispute to a certain extent. This is where I think institutions, clarity of pricing, especially if there's properties trading, so you actually do have market prices and more transparency around those things, those aspects would be very, very helpful. If those aspects are not helpful, then I think some type of more orderly process of slum redevelopment would be great, because what is happening in a lot of places is when slum redevelopment happens, if it's chaotic or sometimes left to the market, so to speak, then some slum residents end up being displaced or evicted without compensation. And there's a lot of research that shows that there's a lot of very bad outcomes for this current generation and the next generation as well.
Maisie, you've done work in Jakarta on the Kampung Improvement Program. That's correct, isn't it? Tell me about that, because that is a response to informal slum housing in the heart of the city.
Yes. So the idea of slum upgrading can be traced back to the 1920s when the Dutch were trying to improve kampungs or slums or informal settlements next to the Dutch settlements. The particular program we study is a very famous program. It's one of the world's largest. It's called KIP, the Kampung Improvement Program. And it lasted for around 15 years from 1969 to 1984. It was a huge program. It covered 5 million residents and 25% of the land. It's a very famous program. And so it's been studied quite a bit. And from what we know, the program was pretty successful in its execution. It provided basic upgrades to a lot of residents at that time. And it also provided a 15-year verbal guarantee to allow residents to live there. And so the government said, you know, we'll improve the drainage canals, we'll pave the paths, and we will not evict you. And so you can stay for 15 years. And some of that was also to encourage residents to improve their housing as well. Mm-hmm. What we focus on is 4 decades later, how do these neighborhoods look like and how do they compare to places that were not upgraded? It's very much related to this very important debate policymakers have when they're considering all these policy tools that we now need to consider, sites and services or slum upgrading on site. Mm-hmm. And so one aspect that policymakers grapple with is, well, if we improve slums and we make them more attractive, will this make slums persist longer? And so that is the part that where we come in. So we look at these improved neighborhoods 40 years later, and there we bring a lot of data to bear to compare upgraded neighborhoods and not upgraded neighborhoods that are just side by side. And also like in places that are in the city center and in the middle or the periphery. One nice thing about the program is pretty large scale. So we can actually see a lot of these comparisons in center versus peripheral areas. And our main finding is that 40 years later, on average, upgraded places have lower land values, wow, shorter heights, and they tend to be more informal. Based on a photographic database that we collected, that is echoing some of the concerns of the policymakers that perhaps some of these slums have stayed informal. And by staying informal, and as those non-upgraded slums have formalized, this is when we start to see a reversal of outcomes. So it's, in the short run, it could be good. But in some places, in the long run, you might see this reversal in terms of market value.
So it's a completely unintended consequence.
Yes.
Because by doing exactly what normally doesn't happen to informal housing, making it much more livable, people have stayed there. And that's not really good for the city as a whole at this point.
Yes, I think it's really about the perspective you're trying to take. Mm-hmm. So I think if you talk to the planners who planned this program, they will say this is one of the objectives of the program, is to allow these residents to stay and stay longer. What we are trying to take is the perspective from the city, a little bit of what Vernon talked about, mm-hmm, which is now city's needs of land has changed. From the city's perspective, what are the costs and benefits from delaying this formalization process, mm-hmm, in 25% of the land? The nice thing I said about having this 25% of the land being treated under this program, we do find that 78%, a large part of the effects that we find, is concentrated within 5 kilometers of the CBD. And so elsewhere, we actually see less of this type of unintended consequences, so to speak.
You know, there is a tension here between people like myself who try or take a long, and Macy, you're taking a longer term view of the city and thinking, yeah, about what's going to happen over the decades and the centuries, and programs, particularly from the World Bank, where you invest in slum improvements and you think, well, we can't relocate slum residents, we can't tear down slums because that's, mm-hmm, going to displace a neighborhood. And that's going to happen in the long term. I love to tell a story at LSE, right, where across the Kingsway from LSE in 1905 was a slum.
Yes.
What the British called a slum at the time. So outdoor plumbing, you know, not the best construction and so on. And within 5 years, that was gone and you would put up modern buildings. I mean, it's unimaginable that that slum would still be there today in modern London. And you are going to renew, and that's going to be a natural process of city growth.
That's why like the context matters. I think in our context for Jakarta, I think the long run, we only have one cross-section. So we're looking at the program 4 decades later. But yes, in some other cities, I will say this long run, unintended consequence can happen much faster. It really is depending on the pace of urbanization and the demand for land. And in some cities, that long run can happen a lot faster.
There is a tension here between what is best for the development of the city and what is best for the people who are living in those environments. How do we resolve this tension? Can we analyze this and see what the impact is on this development, Maisie?
So I think we analyze this from a theoretical or academic perspective first. Let me start with that. Mm. And then just to quantify, I think the key pieces that I think are useful to quantify. And so at the end of our paper, this is actually joined with my colleague, Nina Harari. We have this welfare exercise. Just as a benchmarking exercise, we say, what if we made non-KIPP places and KIPP places similar? What would happen to the city as a whole in terms of welfare?
Yeah.
And our finding there is that the city as a whole, there would be a welfare gain of 3.3%, but there would also be inequality effects. So the high skill will gain more, which naturally makes sense because now if we formalize a lot of the CBD, mm-hmm. there will be more formal housing that will be cheaper. More high skill can move into the city center, but also there will be benefits to high skill and low skill because there are agglomeration spillovers from that as well. And so the city as a whole will benefit. The low skill will be hurt. There will be less land allocated to informal housing. The low skill will be displaced far away from the city. And so they are harmed. And so just as a starting point, we quantify the gains to the city as a whole, and then the winners and losers and how the high skill and the low skill will win and lose. 78% of the gains can be achieved just doing this exercise within 5 kilometers of the CBD. Details matter a lot in how we do this. We do have some counterfactuals that consider this a bit more in the sense of like, well, actually, if we build taller and we allow zoning reform together, then maybe fewer low skill will be displaced. Mm-hmm. So how to do this will matter a lot. And then the details matter a lot. But at the end, we do try to provide this welfare exercise to quantify it.
Part of the way we do these welfare exercises is to show that there is this overall gain, and the gains are sufficiently large to compensate the poor for their losses or more than compensate them. So, you know, in Nairobi, we were looking at Kibera, what was the value of a piece of land per household in Kibera? It was about $10,000 if it remained in slum use forever. If it was formalized, it was about $27,000. Mm-hmm. That's a $16,000 gap. That's a huge amount for these slum households that are paying, you know, $600 or $700 a month in rent. The political issue is the will to help these people that you're displacing. And that's not just a developing country issue. It was the same issue in the U.S. with urban renewal in the 1960s. Displacing neighborhoods, you weren't adequately compensating people, you weren't helping them move, you weren't thinking about moving to some degree neighbors together, you weren't doing any planning in that, you simply displaced people. I think the issue here is that this is a segment of the population that has fewer political rights, is weaker politically, weaker representation. And so the fact that they suffer losses gets ignored in the political process.
So the research you're talking about, it's extremely important. As you say, though, that a lot of how urban development is done is very political, and it's done by people to whom economists don't talk. Is this sort of research a template for how economics can maybe in future have more influence over how cities are planned?
I'd like to think so. In the current work that we're doing in Tanzania, we have a lot of local partners in terms of people in local governments, people at the national level in the Ministry of Lands, and part of our work is dissemination, is going in and disseminating to local planners, to the Ministry of Lands, to academics as well, but mostly people working in government and policymakers and people on the ground involved in implementing programs in Tanzania to provide essentially greenfield housing. We come to them and we say, you know, this is what we found about what's already being done, and here are some suggestions, and we hope that we're contributing to a dialogue that leads to improvements. I mean, one of the things they've done is reduce the plot size, the minimum plot size that they imposed, which was way too large, and they've reduced that in response to, I think, partly what we've said. And so you hope that by going in and talking to people, not just, you know, high-level politicians, but they're bureaucrats who are actually involved in implementing policies and doing the planning, and you talk to them about what's reasonable. And I think that's part of the responsibility of a researcher, is that you go back and you tell people what you found in a context that works for them.
I think like land is one of the key resources, and economics is about how we can use markets to promote and more equitable allocation of land. It also affects where people live and work, is where we put housing, where we put infrastructure. There needs to be more research because it's a very important topic.
And if those researchers, young researchers, come to you and say, I really want to get involved in this, where should I be directing my energy? What would you advise them, Vernon?
I would advise them to learn about the local context, to go and spend time there, to read about it, and then to think about, all right, we have these economic models that are really designed for developed countries, and make a bunch of assumptions. What happens if we change those assumptions? We recognize the inadequacies of institutions. We recognize the inadequacies of government funding. And then to think about questions where that do have, to some degree, at least hopefully, a policy focus. Unfortunately, a lot of our work is to sort of do research, have some findings, and then be top down, go in and prescribe, well, you ought to do this. And ought to do this doesn't mean a lot, right? It's really, how do you convince people to really change what they're doing, at least at the margin? How do you give them a bolder vision? So I think it's to go in and learn about the country you want to work in, and to spend time there, and then to, at some point, you know, you do your work, and then to give some back a little bit, at least.
We talked a lot about land allocation. I think very, very closely related would be housing shortage. There's a big issue. Like Vernon said, you know, it's not just low-income housing, it's also middle-income housing. There's just severe housing shortage, environmental issues, housing finance. There needs to be a lot more data, how we can use data to help improve the capacity of governance, planning. I think that's a very, very useful topic to dedicate some attention to.
After this, I think you might have some students knocking on your door. Maisie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Vernon, thank you as well.
Thank you very much. Take care, Tim.
The course is designed for PhD students and researchers in economics and related fields, but it's open to all. You can find out about it at igc.org, watch recordings of the lectures, and download slides and reading lists. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. We are there. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. And if you like what you hear, please tell others about it, and then they can find out about Vox Dev Talks too.